Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to our virtual meeting. I want to talk tonight about spiritual practice, like why we do spiritual practice. I mean, maybe you don't even think of yourself as having a spiritual practice. I know I've been asking people this question a lot recently, and sometimes people after doing a meditation with me are like, but I don't have a spiritual practice. So maybe you don't conceive of it that way. What we're doing, you know, historically, the teachings of the Buddha have been passed down from Southeast Asia all the way teacher to student to us here. And originally it was created as a kind of spiritual practice for people. And so I'm wondering for you all, why do you meditate? How do you frame your meditation practice? How do you frame your spiritual practice? Maybe you view your spiritual practice as broader than just a meditation practice. I like to think of, for myself, my spiritual practice as including a whole bunch of different things. It's in some ways, it is how I frame my life. So all the things that are arising, I view them through the frame of a spiritual practice. So right before the pandemic, my husband and I decided to sell our house in the East Bay. We lived in a little teeny house in the East Bay in Richmond and move up to Northern California to open a retreat center. And then the pandemic hit. And we didn't get to open the retreat center in the way that I had imagined. And so for me, looking at my life through this lens of a spiritual practice, how can I practice with that disappointment? I'm sure there have been disappointments for you in your life, even aside from a global pandemic, but especially during a global pandemic, where we do have disappointments, where our ideas about what we want to happen or what should happen, it's not quite what really shows up. And so how do you frame that for yourself? How do you work with that? So last weekend, it was only last weekend, it's kind of amazing, we had a New Year's Eve retreat here, and I had an amazing time. There was a small group of people. It was supposed to be 9 people coming, but 3 people canceled, but we still had a group of 6 people coming and to practice, and we did meditation together. I do some movements. We did some movement together, and we did some outdoor practice, and we ate lots of good food, and we were all tested ahead of time. And it was just so amazing to me. And my friends keep asking me, what was so amazing about it? I'm like, well, it's that we were in person, and that I got to teach in person, and that the people weren't just little squares on a Zoom screen in front of me, but there was like this interactiveness, and that we could laugh together, and that we could feel each other, and we could feel the sincerity of our practice together, and feel the support too of our practice together. And so it was pretty amazing. And then everybody left, and our septic tank broke, which is actually got fixed later in the week, but the septic tank broke. So things got backed up, and I started teaching the new year. I had taken December off of teaching. And so I started teaching on Zoom. So I had this amazing time, retreat time, practicing with people. And then the septic broke, and then teaching on Zoom versus in person. And I have a 6-month program. It's actually a program. It's a repeating program that I do that I call Yoga and Dharma. And it's been going for 5 or 6 years now. And there's a core group of people that are staying. And then other people come into the group sometimes. And sometimes the core group leave and they come back. But it runs every 6 months, or, you know, sometimes the programs are 10 months long. It just depends. And so next weekend is the start of this program. And we haven't been able to meet in person since the beginning of the pandemic. And I had decided for this iteration of the program, which is starting next weekend, that we would meet in person and that we would all get tested before we did, but we would actually have a practice period together in person. And it was supposed to be next weekend. And I've been thinking about it this week and talking to the people in the group, we're probably not going to be able to meet in person next weekend, probably not. And so between the septic breaking and going back on Zoom and this thing that I was so looking forward to doing in person with people. I had a bit of lassitude and this is super grumpy actually about things this week. I don't know if you're having that happen too. You know, I've been so actually I count myself as completely fortunate and privileged to have made it through so far the pandemic with very little hardship, quite honestly. And so this came along and I was a little bit surprised how deeply I was reacting to it and how upset I was over it. And so then, of course, when something arises where there's disappointment and grumpiness and upsetness, it's not that I have to try and fix myself with my practice. I actually don't frame my practice in that way. I frame it as a place, right? A place for me to offer myself compassion, to hold myself within that. Because everything will shift. The mood will shift. Things will shift. The septic tank did get fixed and the sun came out, right? Things shift. But can I hold myself within everything, within what's called sometimes in these teachings, the eight worldly winds, pleasure and pain, gain and loss? Can I hold myself within that? In a place of compassion? And can I remember the wisdom too, that all things pass? And can I remember too, the wisdom that this is the human condition, that we are disappointed, that things are unsatisfactory sometimes, this first noble truth. So my practice helps me frame everything that is happening in my life. And I would call this really wise view. Our wise understanding as part of the Buddhist Eightfold Path. How are we looking at our practice? Do we sit down and meditate and try and be like the best meditator or disappointed when the mind wanders? Or can we have a broader view and begin to see within the practice, the strands within the sitting practice or within our life too, the strands of the Buddhist teachings and how that can support us to our own awakening? So why, I'm so curious why you all have a spiritual practice and how does it relate to your life? So for me, to be quite clear, this moment, it was actually yesterday afternoon where the kind of the peak of the disappointment and grief and upset about the situation. And it's kind of a small situation. And there's a way where I could put myself down. Oh, it's just a small situation. It's not that bad. It's, you know, just get over yourself, just move on. It's all impermanent. But really, like, how can I hold myself within that in compassion? How can I be tender and soft around that so that it moves through and it gets digested, so that the experience gets digested and I can be more awake and alive and able to meet the next moment in my life? So when we're sitting in meditation, we're learning to stay. We're learning to stay with ourselves because it's so simple. We sit down and I said tonight, and you've heard probably some of you hundreds of times for years, come back to the breath. And I've been thinking about this recently and how it's maybe a little more helpful to frame this as a coming back practice rather than a staying practice, because our mind is like everything else. It changes, it shifts. And so framing the sitting practice as a coming back. So we're practicing staying with ourselves rather than this idea that we're going to get to a meditation or we're going to get to a point in our life where things are evened out, smoothed out, everything's perfect. There's no anything else. But that's a misunderstanding about how life works because things are impermanent. So in our meditation, we're learning how to stay, how to bear witness with ourselves. So sometimes you might have heard this. It's pretty common. I've heard it. I've actually seen cartoons about it, like New Yorker style cartoons, where the idea that a spiritual practice is about climbing a mountain and getting to the very peak. It's like the pinnacle of human experience. We're transcending life and moving up and out. And I think that's one way to frame practice, but that's not actually how I frame practice. So here's a quote from Pema Chodron. It's fairly long-ish, but I think it's very powerful and worthy. I'll read it slow so we have time to take it in. So she's talking about this idea or this meme really of spiritual practice being a transcendent thing. She says, the problem with that metaphor is that we're leaving everybody else behind, that the suffering in the world continues, unrelieved by our own personal escape. But it's really as if we could escape life anyway, because we can't. So she goes on, she says, on the journey of the warrior Bodhisattva. Do you know what Bodhisattva is? Bodhi means awakened, and Sattva is heart-mind. So in the journey of the warrior Bodhisattva, awakened heart-mind. So it's a journey. She says, the path goes down, not up, as if the mountain pointed towards the earth instead of the sky. Instead of transcending the suffering of all creatures, we move toward turbulence and doubt however we can. Okay. This is actually, I think, quite radical. I feel like this is taking me a long time, years. I might be kind of slow, but to understand. She says, we're moving toward turbulence and doubt however we can. We explore the reality and unpredictability of insecurity and pain. Doesn't that sound like the first noble truth? We explore the reality and unpredictability of insecurity and pain. The first noble truth is the truth of dukkha, our dissatisfaction. It's really the truth of unpredictability and insecurity. And she's saying we try not to push it away. If it takes years, if it takes lifetimes, we let it be as it is. This part I underlined. At our own pace, without speed or aggression, we move down and down. Isn't that interesting? At our own pace. Sometimes it's hard. We can't face it. The difficulties are too much. And we need to find help from others. We need to take a break. So she's saying, at our own pace, without aggression, we move down and down. With us move millions of others. This is beautiful. With us move millions of others. I think about right now at this point in the pandemic, we're at a different place. We are at a different place, and the illness tends to be less severe, but probably right now on this earth, on this beautiful earth, there are millions of people. Maybe somebody even in this room is not well, is sick with COVID or otherwise. So with us move millions of others, our companions in awakening from fear. At the bottom, we discover water, the healing water of bodhicitta. The healing water of this awakened heart mind. Bodhicitta is our heart, our wounded, softened heart. So I've been asking people, I love to talk about people, ask people what they do when they meditate. I think I find it so fascinating how people's minds are so different and how we all learn meditation in different ways and understand it differently. But in general, when I ask people, you know, what do you do when something's difficult in a meditation practice? What do you do? So often I hear all sorts of different techniques. So I count the breath a little more, or I try and focus more, or I open my eyes, or there's so many different techniques. And it's so rare that I hear people say something like, I soften around the difficulty and put a hand on my chest, or I take a breath. And isn't that what she's saying? She's saying right, like the awakening is right down there in the thick of things. We discover the love that will not die. This love is bodhicitta. It is gentle and warm. It is clear and sharp. Isn't that interesting? Those are, in my mind, sound kind of contrasty, like gentle and warm and clear and sharp. It's both. It is open and spacious. She also calls this the path of the warrior, right? At the beginning of the quote, she said the bodhisattva warrior path. This is courageous. This takes a lot of courage. It takes courage to turn towards our suffering. So it is gentle and warm. It is clear and sharp. It is open and spacious. The awakened heart of a bodhicitta is the basic goodness of all beings. So she's framing our spiritual practice as turning towards difficulty. That's one way to frame it. she's talking about a spiritual practice as awakening compassion. So the Buddha, when he was asked what he teaches, he said something like, I teach only a handful of things. There are many, many things that I know, but I only teach the smallest amount. And really what he teaches and what he said is, I teach suffering, or I teach that which is hard to bear, or in Pema Chodron's language, insecurity. And I teach the end of it. So I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. So that's another way to frame your practice. I like this way. Like, how do we work with our own dukkha and work with the dukkha of the people around us in this world? And how do we work to end it? You could also think of your spiritual practice or your spiritual awakening as a coming into alignment with the way things are. So we have in this tradition what's called the three marks. We have there's dukkha, which I've been talking about, and there's impermanence, and there is not self. So we could think of think of your spiritual practices coming into alignment, because when we're out of alignment with the way things are, that's when we suffer. So coming into alignment with this three marks, that everything's changing. I think this is really true. And if I ask anybody anywhere, even somebody who has no spiritual practice whatsoever, or doesn't frame their life in that matter, are things changing? Of course, we all say things are changing. Without change, our children would not grow up. We would not be able to eat food. Like, life wouldn't be able to be as it is, that everything is impermanent. All things are impermanent. But so often when things change, we get startled and upset. It's like we forget, and we, with our minds, try and hold on. With our minds and our hearts, try and hold on in this big river of life. I think that the meditation instruction which I gave, which hopefully worked for some of you, I'm sure it didn't work, whatever that means, but was helpful, let's put it that way, for some of you, to what are you aware of? For me, sometimes when I use that instruction, I can see so clearly that just even sitting down, there's this river of experience that's always changing. It's 35 minutes and just one thing, and then the next thing, and the next thing. There's a thought, there's a body sensation, there's a sound. It's this flow of changing experience, this river. And so we could think of, maybe you do, that your spiritual practice is coming into alignment with that impermanence and seeing that. So I've been also, I asked my husband, it's a too long a story to tell why I'm asked him this, but I asked him to give me the title. If you were to title an autobiography about himself, what would the title of his autobiography be? And he said he would title his autobiography Interested. And I thought that was really interesting, right? Like the quality of mind. And so often when we meditate, we think, oh, I'm trying to get calm. And we need that. We need that calm because our lives can be very busy and the mind can be distracted and we can be tormented by our thoughts. But the whole of a meditation practice is not just about calming down. It's actually also about seeing clearly. And to see clearly, we must be interested. I have this cat that's new in our family, and he's so like this curiosity killed the cat. Like he's always into something and looking around, and I love to kind of watch him because I can feel that sense of curiosity and interest to see how the mind works, to see how we're suffering, and to see to the end of suffering. We need to have some curiosity about it, some engagement, some interest. So maybe your spiritual awakening for you is to cultivate a curious, interested frame of mind. I know for me, for years, and I would say it's still continuing. I've had the intention or aspiration, I like that word, aspiration with my practice, to find my way to a sense of trust. And I would even use the word faith. And I don't mean this word faith as any kind of dogma, Because whenever there's a dogma, the mind is hardened around something and made it solid. But looking at my aspiration of practice to help me come into awareness, and I don't mean just intellectually, but come into awareness of the deep interconnectedness of all things, that we are all held in this earth, that without the earth, you would not be here, without the sky, without the blue sky, without the rain, without your parents, without their parents. When we start to look closely, we see that everything is arising in our lives in concert with each other, depending on other things. And that for me, part of how I frame my spiritual practice is starting to let my bones soak that in. Because when I know that, I feel held, and there is a sense of trust and faith and confidence. Sometimes people think about their spiritual practice as the cultivation of responsiveness. We can think about so often the habit mind's pretty reactive. Like the habit mind's reactive, and we're just going and kind of ping-ponging throughout our day. Sometimes if we're on autopilot, like the next thing and the next thing, and I like this and I don't like that, and trying to organize life to line up to our preferences. It is kind of a limited way of looking at things. But instead, the quality of mindfulness is a quality of awakeness or curious or aliveness to what is here. And when we are present, when there is this quality of heartfulness, mindfulness, that there's more capacity to respond to life, that we have more choices. So for example, if there's an email that came my way that stirred me up, that aggravated me, or whatever it might be, and I type out a response, if there's no mindfulness, there's a reaction, I hit send and it's gone. It's a very simple example. You've all heard this example many times from many teachers. And when there's a bit of mindfulness, when there's a bit of presence, there might be a little like, don't hit send, wait a moment, see. So the quality of practicing heartfulness, of practicing mindfulness, gives us a little bit of space. I think sometimes we have this idea, going back to that, spiritual practice is climbing a mountain. We're going to like transcend and get rid of all our rough edges. But really, mindfulness is giving us a little bit of choice. Like it's just like a little bit of window. A little bit of window, and we can remember to take a breath, and we have a little bit more choice. Sometimes we, maybe many times, like even in meditation, we don't have like a thought comes. We wish it hadn't come. There it is, though. Could be a tormenting thought. And then the choice isn't in like not having the thought. The choice is in how we're responding. So maybe for you, you frame your meditation practice or your spiritual practice as the place where you're training. We have neuroplasticity, training towards more choice. I do think Pema Chodron, she really emphasizes that our practice is training us to meet difficulty with compassion, to meet difficulty with compassion. So one time, a long time ago, I heard a talk, and maybe some of you have heard it too, from Gil Fonsale. Oh, he was talking about our spiritual practice. He was framing it as like getting into a river. So we get into a river and we let the river carry us to the ocean. And just like a river, sometimes the water goes fast of our practice, and sometimes it sort of seems like we're not going anywhere at all. But really the river is emptying to the ocean. And our job, instead of trying to willpower our way, climb that mountain of enlightenment, our job is just keep us within the bounds, keep us within the banks of the river. And maybe that's with the Eightfold Path, where we're cultivating the practices of wise speech and wise intention and wise understanding and wise ethics, right? Like our ethical behavior, wise action, and our mindfulness and our concentration and our effort practices. So maybe for you, your spiritual practice is a way to get in the river and let the river take you to the ocean. I also think about this, this metaphor is really beautiful, and we can think of the refuges that we chanted at the beginning. The refuge of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are keeping us in the banks of the river of spiritual practice. So you're doing this. You practice meditation tonight, and you're listening to a Dharma talk, and maybe you listen to a Dharma talks all the time, or you do practices, or you come together in community, Sangha. So having the refuges of the teachings, of the Buddhist teachings, and the practices, and the refuge of your own mind and your own heart, and the refuge of the community to help keep you in the river so that the river can carry you. Some people think of or frame their spiritual practice as a way to cultivate gratitude for the immense good fortune that we have. And not to say that there aren't hardships, because there are hardships. And that, of course, there are many, many difficult things to bear. But even within that, there are so many places to be grateful. And maybe for you, you frame your spiritual practice as the cultivation of gratitude. I've also heard over the years, so many teachers talk about their teachers, their, in particular in the Mahayana, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, where I'll listen to a teacher give a talk, and they talk about their teacher and how much sort of awe and humility they have. Like awe, like A-W-E, like, whoa, like this is just amazing and boggling, and humility too, of this sense of there but for the grace of God go I. So I want to put you in small groups in a second and let you have a chance to reflect with each other what it is that you, how you frame your spiritual practice and how it impacts your life, how it impacts your life. So I have to say, when we do these breakout rooms or the small groups, if it's challenging for you, maybe take a breath and consider being a bodhisattva warrior and holding yourself through that. And also know that you can frame this question however you like. You don't like the question, you can go tangential. It's totally fine. You can see what arises. Be curious, remember? Like the curious or interested mindset. What can come out of your mouth? I also have to say that someone emailed me this quote the other day, and I thought it was awesome, which is why she emailed it to me. She said, I didn't look it up to confirm it, but she said that Alan Watts said that you are something like, you have no obligation to be the same person you were 5 minutes ago. So I'm going to give you a chance to speak to each other, and you're going to say some things. And it might be upon reflection, you realize that what you said isn't actually quite exactly true, or was true in the moment, but then has already shifted. So that this opportunity to converse with each other is an opportunity to just be curious about what arises. So if you go tangential, you go tangential. Maybe something else interesting will arise that you need to hear yourself say. And maybe you'll say something and it changes, and that's okay. And when you're listening to each other, it's this a beautiful opportunity to listen, to practice listening instead of planning what you're going to say. Hopefully I'm giving enough talk right now so that you are planning what you're going to say now and not when you're listening, right? But just, you know, do what you can, don't do what you can't. It's a practice, not a perfect. I love all those little things. It's a practice, not a perfect. So I'll put you in groups, or actually I'm not going to do it, but I think probably Corey or somebody's going to do it, put you in groups. And we have, let's do this for 10 minutes, and we're going to be in groups of three or four. So each person will have 2 to 3 minutes each. And it's important to make sure that everybody gets a chance to talk, because I know some people really love these exercises. And if you happen to be paired with someone who really hates these exercises, guess who's going to do all the talking? So just try and moderate with each other as best you can so that everybody gets a couple minutes to talk. And the question, again, you can frame it however you like, and it's really an opportunity to just learn from each other and learn from yourself and learn from yourself too. So I want to make sure that there's no questions about what I want you to talk about, the general area of how do you frame your spiritual practice? What are you doing? And how does it impact your life? So those are really big questions that cannot necessarily be answered well in 2 to 3 minutes. So it's just a little bit of taste. And is that clear? Does anybody have any questions about that? We're good on that. Okay. And so if whoever's putting us into the small group can put us into the small group for 10 minutes, I think that will be good. So we'll have 10 minutes. And I know some of you are in couples, so just try and make sure everybody gets a little moment to talk. Okay. And I'm ready whenever you are. Welcome back. How did it go? How did it go? Yeah? It was okay? Nobody spoke in my group. This is so much pressure because I was there. It was a group fail. Were there other group fails or it was okay?
We all talked a lot.
We had a great time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We talked a lot. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. Good, good. Did anybody have anything in particular that they wanted to share before we close for the evening? About something you learned or how, like just anything, or questions too, but questions are fine too, but also anything you learned. Yeah, Deborah, you'll have to unmute yourself.
I think, I don't know if I learned this or I was reminded of this, how in a nanosecond or maybe 2 or 3 minutes, strangers become not strangers.
Yeah.
And one of the people in our group used the word interconnected, how we're, in their practice, the learning about interconnection. And so I think that's what I just said, how in a few minutes, there's familiarity. And it's just a blessing.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to thank you for that phrase, framing your practice, because that was something, as I told the group, I said, I really needed to hear, because sometimes you could just forget. And so I was like, okay, these are the elements of my practice. And some of the basics of Buddhism, particularly for me coming to opening to suffering and with compassion and being remembering to do that and remembering to be grateful. So I really appreciate that word framing, because it kind of helps me just organize the whole vehicle, so to speak.
Good, good. Thank you. It's nice to know what we're doing sometimes to take a little moment to reflect on it, because it'll be different for every person, even though it is the Buddhist teachings and we all hear these teachings, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, but each of us will resonate at different points in our life with different parts of the teaching and how, yeah. So I'm glad that word frame worked for you. I think we have time for one more if there's anybody
Rick's
else.
Rick has had his hand up.
Okay, Rick.
Yes, I actually kind of fell asleep, and then, as I do often in these sanghas, and I woke up in this with just three people there, and they asked me what my spiritual practice was. And so I found it very interesting, because I never really asked myself that. And so had to kind of explore that. So it was interesting to be asked what my spiritual practice is and to try and figure that out. So I rambled on, and I don't know if I figured anything out, but it was a good exercise, I think, maybe.
Good, good. Thank you.